from Amakar's house. Amakar was not a drinker by nature, and his housemate was not either. And they knew the bicyclist as an acquaintance, nothing more, not a drinking buddy. The bicyclist apparently knew that they were in the middle of eviction proceedings. My understanding is they are the housemates have to be out of there by the end of March. First, the bicyclist asked Amakar for his cell phone, and we have no knowledge that the cell phone was ever returned to Amakar. We also know that the bicyclist confronted Amakar and tried to prevent him from entering his own home, saying, "You don't live here," on three different occasions.
Yeah, you mean did he lend the bicyclist the cell phone? Is that why Amakar gave him the cell phone?
No. First, he lent him the cell phone as a friendly gesture because he had seen this man on more than one occasion, three doors down, socializing, drinking on the steps of a house. Okay? But they weren't friends. They were acquaintances. He let him borrow the cell phone for a moment. The cell phone has not been seen since.
All right, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Bill Simpich. He's an attorney who's been investigating this latest shooting. So then, again, back to the police confront Amakar. He's running away. They tell him to drop the gun. He drops the gun, and then they open fire instantaneously. Is that the story from eyewitnesses?
Eyewitnesses say the knife was dropped after these ununiformed officers ordered him at gunpoint to drop it. And he dropped it, ran, and was shot between two cars as he was in the street.
So the police were not in any imminent danger?
No imminent danger. It looks like they shot him to prevent him from fleeing.
Is that legal to shoot somebody, to kill somebody, because they're fleeing?
He was fleeing.
And is that legal to shoot him? Can the police say he was fleeing, he's a dangerous criminal, we have to shoot him?
Well, now they also said that he was trying to steal this guy's bicycle. There's no evidence we have of any attempt to steal his bicycle whatsoever. In fact, the bicycle was left in between somebody's door and stairs in their yard. It was not in any danger at any time. The bicyclist was in handcuffs at the scene of the crime, while Amakar lay there dead for an hour. Instead of taking him to the hospital, they let him bleed out. For all we know, he could have survived his wounds. We saw them giving him CPR on the scene, but they didn't pick him up and get him out of there for more than an hour. And even with severe gunshot wounds, people survived. There was no attempt to rush him to one of the best trauma centers at 24th and Ventura. SF General.
Again, we're speaking with Attorney William Simpich, who heard the shots that led to the death of one more brown victim of what is clearly, as we were talking about earlier with Frank Latta, part of a massive gentrification program where the police are defending this new group of gentrifiers. And we've been watching this in this very beautiful, important San Francisco neighborhood.
That's exactly what it was.
Talk about
that. Well, the problem was manifold. The police put down crime tape and refused to let people return to their homes who weren't at the scene. For the people who were at the scene, they refused to let them leave their homes. There's reports they told people to leave their windows because there was, quote, danger. They came to our house and said, lock the doors for no good reason. They went to the house down the way and tried to take away all the cameras because they knew that that individual had gotten a very good firsthand view of the crime scene.
Wow. And when were people let back into their houses who were prevented from going home?
It took 2 hours for my neighbors next door to get home.
Now this for this kind of situation to lock down a neighborhood, what? It's pretty impressive to see them go at it this way.
It's impressive if you want to eliminate witnesses and destroy evidence.
What do you mean?
Well, the problem is that the cops screwed up. I think they realized they'd screwed up within moments. The knife's on the ground. The man's not packing a gun. There's no credible story of him trying to endangering anybody in any way. The most the cops could come up with was that he was stealing a bicycle, which we don't believe is true. They realized they'd screwed up. So you could see them from the windows conferring with each other while the body's lying there on the ground and there's no CPR. It was kind of like saying, now what do we do? Because the undercover car was double parked right there on the scene. I mean, it was an undercover situation. And the undercover cops had blown their cover and had shot this guy. And now they're standing there in the full light of all these neighbors. And they took every action they could to make sure that not a neighbor was on the street from 24th and 27th.
In Folsom.
And if you look at 2858 Folsom, the cops came within 3 feet of putting bullets right through my next door neighbor's window. Well, it looks like we have an independent autopsy set up. It looks like the attorney who is defending the Andy Lopez family, Andy Garcia family in Santa Rosa.
Andy Lopez.
Andy Lopez had it right the first time. It looks like he is going to step in. We have to get confirmation from the family, but he's willing. And and there's a press conference at 5, and there's the police are going to tell their version of the story at 6, and we're going to be telling our version of the story at 5 and at 6 and at 7. So I encourage everybody who can to come to Cesar Chavez School at 22nd and Shotwell in the Mission District in San Francisco as soon as possible.
All right, Bill Simpich, attorney at law, on Folsom, shots fired across the street. We're going to follow this one as we are all the rest.
Really about the extraordinary money laundering that was going on that was levitating the stock market. You know, it was very interesting because one of the challenges of independent business people at the time is when you're running a little restaurant in a place like the place I live in Tennessee, and the franchise next door basically is running $100,000 a year overhead and doesn't need to produce a dime of revenues. That's a real competitive headwinds. There was one franchise which will go unnamed. I used to pay special interest. I first noticed it because in a town nearby, I drove past it, you know, almost once a day for a year, and I never saw a customer in the thing. And finally, I said, okay, I drove by and there was a customer sitting there eating, and I thought maybe it's a Balo doll. And I literally stopped and walked in to see if it was a real human being because it was such an unusual thing to see. And I used to drive, for a long time, I'd drive Tennessee to Washington every month, once a month about. And I started to notice this one franchise, and they were always empty. There was one on Market Street, I think it was 52nd Market in Philadelphia, that was always going gangbusters, that had real business. But otherwise, weekend, weekday, day, night, there were about 24 on the way up. I'd pass them up and back, always empty. Uh-huh. And finally, I'd start to go in and talk to the staff and say, well, you know, how many hours are you open? And what's the, you know, so I'd pro forma out the overhead. And finally, I realized, you know, whatever their business is, it ain't food.
New musical groups have made their appearance in recent years, but none more witty and more inventive than the six men who call themselves the Association.
But we handle the cases. I've seen them across the country. Crazy cases where if you collect rainwater, they're actually taxing you extra or fining you for doing it. That's because you're not using the water system. People that want to live off a generator, for example, periodically are being told they can't do that because the large power companies make money off of it, and they're actually against the law. But see, all this is happening, and you know, why I wrote my book, A Government of Wolves, it comes from the great quote by Edward R. Murrow, who fought McCarthyism in the 50s. He says, a nation of sheep begets a government of wolves. We've, in many ways, we've become sheep-like. We've just allowed these things to happen. And in other countries that I've studied, Nazi Germany especially, the people were asleep. Jose Guerrero was in his home in Arizona, sleeping. He heard a large noise in his house, a loud noise. It was a flashbang grenade. He was astute. He thought there had been burglaries in the neighborhood recently. He gets at the end of his hallway, he takes his women and children, he put them in a closet. He stood at the end of his hallway by the bedroom with his rifle. He only had one gun, a hunting rifle. In comes the SWAT team. They see him at the end of the hallway. They fire 70-some times, hit him 50 times. He falls head first. They wouldn't even let the medics take care of him. He bled to death on his own floor. They were looking for drugs. There were no drugs in Jose Guerrero's home. So that's the result of some of them. I don't know if you saw here in Atlanta a couple weeks ago. They went into a home in Atlanta, flashbang grenade in the middle of the night, it landed in a baby's crib, burned half the baby's face off. The officers said they were really sad it happened. But here's the thing. There was no reason to go. There was no violence. There was no reason to do that. If they thought there were drugs in the home, they should have got a warrant. But they didn't do it. So what happens is you got a baby scarred for life and the baby's in a coma. This is happening in America, folks. And you said it sounds like military raids. They are military raids. They're dressed in military outfits, the military gear, which, by the way, the Department of Defense and Department of Homeland Security hands out to them basically free.
Now, you're saying that some of these raids, they don't even have warrants.
No. No knock raids. A lot of them don't have warrants. Jose Guerrero, they didn't have a warrant to enter his home. The guy got shot. They were doing a neighborhood sweep to find marijuana. Here's the key. For marijuana raids, they get federal grants, so they make money off of the grants. Now, I have a question for Americans. Do you think police should be getting monetary grants for raiding people's homes? For marijuana? it doesn't make any sense, except for one reason. Money. In the middle of the night, 3 a.m., if someone's got marijuana, and I think most people that smoke marijuana I've known during my life are stoned, and they're not very dangerous. Just knock on the door with your warrant. Why do you need to do the SWAT team raid? Well, that's how they fund their program.
Some people like go out dancing. Then there's other people, baby, they gotta work. You better watch me now. There's some evil mothers, they'll just tell you that life's just made out of dirt. They're pretty women, baby, they never really faint, and villains always blink their eyes. Their children are the only ones who blush. And that life, life, that life is just to die. But I want to tell you something. Anyone who had a heart, wouldn't turn around and break it. And anyone who's ever played a part, they wouldn't turn around and hate it. They say, Jane, sweet Jane, oh, Jane, sweet Jane.
Yeah, definitely not. Well, you've done so much research and analysis on how the black budget is invading our neighborhoods. And I can't help but think that some of these storefronts are set up there to be a part of that funneling of the money. And they're hidden in plain sight.
Well, here's what I didn't understand, which was, you know, if all of this crazy stuff is going on, when I worked in Washington and Wall Street, I never thought of drugs as being very important. Because the reality, Daniel, is if you look at the amount of money you can generate on financial fraud, it's far greater than on drugs. So I never understood what all the hoopla was about the drugs.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until I moved to Tennessee, you know, I live in a little rural farming community, that I started to understand how drugs intersected with control of the cash flows and the politics in a place and how that translates into control of a wide variety of the overt economy, and then that translates into control of the government money, and then that translates into being able to do all the financial fraud that really makes the financial fraud unbelievably popular. And so I really decided to dig in and understand, well, you know, if the Department of Justice says we're laundering $500 billion to $1 trillion a year of all dirty money, and that translates into a couple thousand dollars per person, you know, where is it? Because if it happens, it happens in 3,100 counties on the ground. So I had done a great deal in the 90s to look at the overt economy through taking government money and basically unpacking it on a place-based basis. So I'll give you an example. You vote for a congressman every 2 years, but you don't get a financial statement that says, here's the sources and uses of money, government funds within your congressional district. So you're paying taxes and your money's being allocated both locally and globally, but you can't see it. And if you're going to hold your Congress critter accountable, you need to be able to see that money. Anyway, so I had done a lot to create place-based financial statements by, you know, whether it was your zip code or your congressional district or your county. And but that was the overt economy. So my question in my travels was, okay, where is the covert side? How does it work? How does it intersect with the overt economy? And who's really doing this? Because it's not Washington Wall Street that's doing this. You know, it's me, it's my family, it's my friends, and we're all pretending we're not doing it, but we are.
Oh, somehow it's deep in there. Yeah.
Yeah, it's in there. It's a huge, you know, business. It's in one sense, it's tiny dollars. But, you know, my guess is if you take out of a poor county $4 to $5 million in pure cash, and then you can lever it in all the different ways you can lever it, you're talking about major economic clout within the economy.
Sure.
So, you know, it's interesting when you study about how the Anglo-American Alliance used drugs to move in on the Chinese Empire or other countries, you know, basically move in and use it to do the equivalent of what I call a financial leverage buyout of a place. It's the same thing that happened after World War II. We opened up the country not only to, you know, we opened up the consumer markets, but we also opened up the consumer markets to illegal goods.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, it's a very interesting study we've done to our own population, what we did to the global population. So it's all part of globalization. We're all equal now.
Right. Well, that's an interesting point about the drugs. And actually, with your X-ray vision, having looked behind the curtain on some of these sensitive issues the way that you have, what is your take on these states like Colorado, for example, legalizing marijuana? And that's spreading to other states. Now, is the black budget behind that? Are these black budget forces getting a piece? Or is this something that they're against and they want to stop this movement? How do you see that?
Well, it's interesting. I think what happened with 9/11 was we changed the budgeting and financial infrastructure at a federal level so that we could start to legalize drugs. In other words, if you look at the use of illegal activities to finance the black budget, I think it was getting very dysfunctional. And the amount of time and effort used in cover-ups, and I think a lot of what happened after 9/11 was a shift to move the black budget on budget, if you will, and to make it much easier to shift money into the black budget without, you know, all kinds of very expensive dysfunction. You know, the margin on organized crime was getting too high.
Yeah.
So it would seem to me that legalization is in certain respects is coming. If you sit down and talk with drug dealers, what you'll find is the number one use of illegal drugs in most counties is pain medication. So they don't have health insurance. They're not.
Academic and author Dr. Michelle Chosudovsky warned that the so-called war on terrorism is a front to propagate America's global hegemony and create a new world order. He was speaking at the International Conference on the New World Order, Recipe for War or Peace. Dr. Chosudovsky said terrorism is made in the U.S. and that terrorists are not the product of the Muslim world. According to him, the U.S. global war on terrorism was used to enact anti-terrorism laws that demonized Muslims in the Western world and created Islamophobia. Elaborating on his argument, Dr. Chosudovsky said that NATO was responsible for recruiting members of the Islamic State, while Israel is funding global jihad elements inside Syria.
Al-Qaeda and the Al-Qaeda-affiliated organizations, including the Islamic State, are not independent organizations. They are sponsored, and they are sponsored by the United States and its allies. It is documented that prior to 2011, there was a process of recruitment of mujahideen to fight in Syria. And this was coordinated by NATO and the Turkish High Command. This report is confirmed by Israeli news sources. And unequivocally, we are dealing with the state sponsorship of terrorism, the recruitment of mercenaries, the training and the financing of terrorism. As much as possible, the United States has delegated its authority to other partners, despite the fact that ultimately this is an initiative of U.S. intelligence, coordinated with the U.S. State Department and the Pentagon.
Dr. Chozdovsky, who is also the founder of the Center for Research in Globalization, further emphasized that the global war on terrorism is a fabrication, a big lie, and a crime against humanity. Echoing Dr. Chozdovsky's arguments, Malaysia's prominent political scientist, Islamic reformist and activist Dr. Chandra Muzaffar said that the U.S. has always manipulated religion to further its global hegemony on sovereign states. For example, he said, the Arab Spring was brought about by Colonel Muammar Muhammad Gaddafi's resistance to U.S. dominance. Earlier, Dr. Chozdovsky launched his new book titled The Globalization of War.
Well, this book is ultimately a reflection on how a global military agenda affects a series of countries, and it also looks into the issue of nuclear war. It is coupled with a broad historical overview. Start with a historical overview, then we get into nuclear war, nuclear energy, Fukushima, and then there's a series of chapters on countries, including Yugoslavia, Haiti, Iraq, Iran, and also more recently on Ukraine, to give a perspective on how this global military agenda is applied for different countries in different parts of the world, and with the ultimate purpose of destabilizing and transforming sovereign countries into territories which are then open space for Western foreign investment.
The one-day conference was organized by the Perdana Global Peace Foundation, founded by Malaysia's former Prime Minister, Dr. Mahathir Mohamad. The anti-war initiative, Perdana Global Peace Foundation, has a single goal of putting an end to war. Founded by Malaysia's former Prime Minister, Dr. Mahathir Mohamad, the foundation encourages dialogues between different nations, people and organizations to foster love and global peace. Its sister foundation, the Kuala Lumpur Foundation to Criminalize War, aims to undertake all necessary measures to criminalize war and energize peace. It also found former US President George Bush and former British Prime Minister Tony Blair, among others, guilty of war crimes. Speaking to reporters at the Perdana Global Peace Foundation's one-day international conference titled The New World Order, Recipe for War or Peace, Dr. Mahathir warned that Malaysia might lose its independence if the government falls prey to the ploys of the U.S. to increase its global hegemony through economic means.
Not covered, and it's cheaper to get marijuana, or they prefer marijuana to, you know, a pharmaceutical painkiller. So you're basically talking about the majority of that market, I think, being competitive with pharmaceuticals. So, and as pharmaceuticals get more liberal and Obamacare happens, you know, there's the line between those two keeps shifting. So that's number one. But number two, if you look at how much of the local share of something like marijuana is going to state revenues, you know, at some point the states are going to want the tax dollars. So you're going to see the local share go from the covert side up onto the overt state budget. And I think that's what's happening.
Oh, yeah.
So if you look at the biggest cash crops in California or in my state, Tennessee, in 2005, we were number two on per capita marijuana revenues, by far the biggest cash crop in a state like Tennessee.
Yeah.
So if you look at any state where it's a huge cash crop, there's going to be real pressure on the state legislature to bring that money into the overt side of their budget. You know, presumably somebody locally is getting the local share on the covert side. Who that is, I don't know.
Right.
But if I was the state legislature, I would be wanting, you know, those dollars. I know we see Mitch McConnell and Rand Paul now promoting legalization of hemp.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, which is not a drug. It's a fantastic economic product. Now, whether that's serious or that's just Mitch and Rand pitching to the, you know, constituents, the small farmers would love that. It would be a great, great news for the small farmers.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, we recently did a show with Professor Peter Dale Scott.
Uh-huh.
And we were talking about drug trafficking, and he mentioned that in the 90s, when the Taliban had the rule of Afghanistan, that the heroin production actually went down to zero.
Right.
And that we went in there and took over, and now it's the largest producer again.
Right.
So there's obviously a link there between our military action and the drug flow out of that region.
Sweet June,
I cried about them killing the Kennedys. Tears ran down my face. And I cried about the murder of Martin. I thought it was such a disgrace. But don't talk to me about conspiracies. There are lone nuts all over the place. So love me, love me, love me. I'm a liberal. I go to peace vigils and rallies. I put my poor conscience at ease. And I vote for the Democratic Party. Though I know it's the corporates they'll please. At least they're the lesser of two evils. The hipper of hypocrisies. So love me, love me, love me. I'm a liberal. GW was a national disaster, and Cheney's a national disgrace. Using big lies and terror and torture to wage wars and put puppets in place. But I cheered when Obama bombed Libya, 'cause killing was correct in that case. So love me, love me, love me. I'm a liberal. I cheered when Obama was chosen, my faith in the system restored. Though he sold out to AIPAC and the banksters, I'm sure that our rights won't be ignored. And he won't talk about revolution or a health plan that's just and assured. So love me, love me, love me. I'm a liberal. Oh, the people of Mesopotamia should all hang their heads in shame. Now I can't understand how their minds work. They're all Muslims, so they must be to blame. And if you talk 9/11 truth to my children, I hope the cops take down your name. So love me, love me, love me. I'm a liberal. Yes, I read daily Kos and the Nation. I've learned to take every view. I'm for Israel and for occupation. I feel like I'm almost a Jew. And when it comes to Iraq and Afghanistan, there's no one more red, white, and blue. So love me, love me, love me. I'm a liberal. Yes, I vote for the Democratic Party. They want UN troops to be strong. I attend all the Bob Dylan concerts. He sure gets me singing those songs. Now I can't send all the money you asked for, but I send my best wishes along. So love me, love me, love me. I'm a liberal. Sure, once I was young and impulsive. I wore every conceivable pin. I even went to anti-war meetings. I learned to sing Blowing in the Wind. How about I've grown older and wiser, and that's why I'm turning you in. So love me, love me, love me. I'm a liberal.
Our freedom. We'll have to always consult them or submit to them or take their orders from them. Then we have lost. We fought for independence, Merdeka. Now we are going to lose our independence. These people are planning that. And if you don't do it, they threaten to cut off trade from you. They threaten to support people who will overthrow the government, give them money, instigate give publicity propaganda for them to overthrow any government that we have, because they want a government that will say yes to them all the time.
The New World Order refers to the emergence of a totalitarian world government. Other prominent speakers at the conference also said that a secretive power elite led by the United States wants to replace sovereign nation states through regime change. But Dr. Thomas Barnett, who had served extensively in the U.S. National Services, refuted these arguments as mere allegations.
When we talk about American hegemony, I like to point out that we don't have any colonies, that we tend to rebuild countries that we defeat militarily. And the biggest problem we have right now is that we've grown tired of that role, and the countries that should be rising and taking more of that role, China, India, ASEAN, refuse to do so. And instead, they blame the United States for continuing to take the role that they don't step up and assume. The oil that comes out of the Middle East does not go to the United States. It goes overwhelmingly to Asia. Iran's biggest importers. India, China, South Korea, Japan. Iran's biggest oil importers. India, China, South Korea, Japan.
Come on and let me.
Saudi Arabia's biggest importers. China, India, South Korea, Japan. And yet it's the Americans who go fight and die in order to keep that economic lifeline.
Bring me your.
Well, my assessment is that the Anglo-American Alliance essentially controls and operates the drug trade globally. Not to say that there isn't, you know, everybody's in on the cash flows. Uh-huh. And the reality is it's the drug money, but it's also the related laundering. It's a big financial. And the reinvest, you know, the power in that thing is the reinvestment of the cash flows.
I see.
And here's the fundamental economics to understand. Let's pick a business, any business. So let's pick the grocery business, and let's say the margins are very thin, 2%, okay? So let's say I have a 2% margin in the underlying business and my stock trades at 10 to 20 times. So on $100, I make $2. If my stock is trading at 10, you know, then my market value is 20, okay? Now, if I can launder, you know, 30% margin drug money through my publicly traded stock, and I can combine a 30% margin with a multiple of 10 or 20 times, then you're talking about a much bigger number, okay?
Yeah.
And a fee flow to the banks, and, you know, it levers on their stock. You know, and God forbid we talk about how you could lever it with debt and derivatives. We won't even go there.
Right.
So the powerful position globally is, you know, normally if Tony Soprano came into Goldman Sachs and said, look, you know, I have this great business and it's 30% margins, but it's all illegal, Goldman Sachs would say, no, you know, we can't do a prospectus for a criminal enterprise.
Yeah.
At least not over, you know, bluntly and overtly and clearly. So the question is, you know, what's interesting is even though a 30% margin is high, the ability to lever your 2% margin with a 10 to 20% at times multiple in the stock market, or to lever it with liquid finance, you know, debt derivatives, that financial leverage is much more powerful. But financial leverage depends on the rule of law. So I've got one guy, Tony Soprano, with a margin of 30%. I've got another guy, let's call him the Masons, and he's got a 2% margin, but a, you know, a 10 to 20 times pop. He wins. He beats Tony Soprano. Now the question is, can somebody come down the middle and combine the, you know, take the 30% and combine it with the financial leverage and do that globally? If they can, they're the winner.
I see.
Because they've got the high margins and the high financial leverage in combination. And that's why, you know, I spent a lot of time in my, I've got an online book called Dylan Reed and the Aristocracy of Stock Profits.
Mm-hmm.
I think you've taken a look at it.
Oh, yeah.
And I spend a huge amount of time explaining to people why so much money is invested in the pretense of the rule of law. You know, I know you're a successful journalist, and you know, sometimes it gets so wacky and Orwellian. Why is everybody spending so much time making up what are obviously complete lies?
Right.
You know, you watch the corporate media, and they struggle not to laugh as they say some of these things.
That's true.
You know, so the question is, why are we spending all this money on the pretense? It's so expensive, you know, and it's so ridiculous at some point. Well, that's because you're trying to preserve that combination of the high margin with the financial leverage. And if you admit to what you're really doing, you run the risk of losing the financial leverage. And ultimately, that has always been the greatest power behind the Anglo-American alliance.
Oh, that's so interesting. Well, you know, the Kill the Messenger movie came out late last year and was widely attacked in the major media. Of course, Kill the Messenger tells the story of investigative reporter Gary Webb, who uncovered a link between the CIA working with the Contras in Central America and the crack epidemic that was happening in Los Angeles. Now, you did a lot of analysis on Webb's book, Dark Alliance, yeah. And you believe that his research was totally legitimate, right?
Yes. Gary, you know, it's interesting because I'm a person who's fascinated by the nuts and bolts of operations.
Yeah.
So when I worked as a regulator in the government, I was very, you know, I had a very, one of the largest line management financial operations. So we had about a portfolio of about, at the time, $350 billion of mortgage insurance in force and about 7,000 people. So I really got very interested in the nuts and bolts of how the line management operation works in government, how you get things done in government, because we were implementing a lot of change at the time. And when I read Gary Webb's Dark Alliance, one of the things I found was that in terms of the nuts and bolts of government operations and enforcement, his
yeah.
entire, all of his work was absolutely impeccable. And there's no way he could do that with his experience unless he really had the story. So I'm convinced Webb had the story. And part of it was when Webb published the Dark Alliance, we were publishing databases of mortgage defaults. And after I read Dark Alliance and sort of read his work, I realized that he was, you know, that a lot of what we were showing with the mortgage defaults was patterns that were very similar to what he was describing with the drugs. And what was very interesting is when he published the story, a real effort was made by the Department of Justice, and it took them about a year to then seize all of our data and databases and software tools
wow.
and keep it under lock and key for 6 years. And I think that's because if we had continued to put up on the internet the data about the mortgage defaults, you know, people like Webb and the different minority journalists who were downloading his documentation were going to put two and two together, and the mortgage game was going to be in jeopardy. And I think the mortgage game, and particularly with the sort of pump and dump of the housing market starting in the mid 90s and ending with the bailouts, you know, that produced fantastic amounts of money that were pulled out of the U.S. government. And so I think, you know, disclosure of the mortgage financing by place was really going to blow the game. I do have to mention one thing about Kill the Messenger.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough, NBC is owned by Comcast. Okay. Kill the Messenger was distributed by a subsidiary of NBC. And you have to ask the question, Daniel, what in the world? Comcast is in the middle of a big merger with Time Warner and has approvals before the Department of Justice. And the Kill the Messenger story is very embarrassing for what was then the current Attorney General, Eric Holder.
Right.
And after Kill the Messenger came out, I think the timing was then Holder resigns. And you have to ask the question, why is Comcast, who's trying to get an approval from the Department of Justice, allowing a subsidiary to come out with this movie at that time? And what does it have to do with Eric Holder's resignation? Big unanswered question. And then, I said this on Money and Markets last night. I said, I have no idea what's going on at Comcast, but if I own the stock, this would make me very nervous.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Well, this is the way that certain hits are organized. And one thing you've explained, like in the case of Eric Holder,
right.
The power group is not afraid to turn on their own.
I remember when the John Corzine story was out there, and he, of course, had done all these shady money deals for his financial pals, but they were only too happy to turn around on him, and he was stuck in a pretty bad situation.
I don't know what the, you know, I would say in Corzine's case, it's probably a well-deserved hit.
No doubt about it.
But I would say Corzine, it looks like, has gotten off pretty light, given yes. what was happening. I mean, basically, Corzine took over a firm and bet the ranch on a market position. Who knows why? Maybe he thought he had inside skinny. But he bet the ranch, and a lot of people got hurt. And if you look at how they got hurt, you know, it's pretty ugly. So, you know, whatever Corzine did, it's not pretty, but we don't know what the real story is. You know, it'd be wonderful in these situations if the real story comes out.
Definitely.
And I think, you know, the tough thing for us, because you and I are both trying to help people understand what's really going on, mm-hmm. is the story is never the story. I always say in America, fact is fiction and fiction is fact.
True.
But, you know, you watch, you know, so you watch Kill the Messenger come out telling the story of how unfairly this reporter was treated. And then you turn around and you watch what's going on with Cosby and Brian Williams. And you say, was this just a training film? You know,
right. Yeah, exactly.
Right. It's a training film. So,